Welcome to New Books in World Affairs, and this is your host, Christian Peterson. And today I have the good fortune of speaking with Edwin van der Heer about his new book, Degrees of Freedom, Liberal Political Philosophy and Ideology, what is put out by Transaction Publishers. Edwin, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Edwin, before we begin, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself.
Yes, I'm an independent scholar. Specialized in the liberal tradition in international political theory. I've wrote a few books one on classical liberalism and international relations theory, focusing on the work of Hume, Smith, Mises, and Hayek. I've also wrote a Dutch book on the political philosophy of liberalism. And this book is more like an extension and translation of the Dutch book. But it's far more it's far more extended, I would say, especially in the methodological field. And I try to write on current affairs as well, on a blog called Notes on Liberty, and I run the Facebook group on libertarianism and IR together with my good friend Lucas Freire.
Excellent. That's interesting stuff. So how did you, you've kind of explained it in your introduction, but I'd like you to wonder if you'd say a little bit more about how you came to write this book.
Well, I guess there's more books. It all starts with a question or even a nuisance. And I guess it was both in my case, because during the research for my PhD thesis, I read a lot of books, obviously, but I never came across a book who would explain the liberal tradition in full. The more you read about liberalism, the more confused you get. The more liberalisms you come across. And I've tried to, in this book, I've tried to make sense of the liberal mess, as I call it, by focusing on the answers liberals can give to the question, what is the justified interference, measure of interference by the state in the life of the individual. I think that's the guiding principle in my book. And I figure out that, if you take that question as a central question, then there are only three different liberalisms. You can explain the world and the world of liberalism by using these three liberalisms. For my background, it's very important that we're not talking just about liberalism in domestic affairs, but I've also added in every chapter the view of the particular liberal variety on international affairs, because I don't think there's much boundary between them other than artificial academic boundaries who've developed over time during the last decades with academic specialization. So I think it's very important to see them as a whole. Also to make it more easy for people to understand how you can explain the current world by using liberal ideas.
What you said struck me, and you do this in the book very well, the way that scholars of political ideology and even people who write about foreign policy have made these artificial boundaries. Like I read the book and I'm like, this makes a lot of sense, because that hasn't been touched a lot. As someone who's, I specialize in US foreign policy, and then, I'd like to think of myself as pretty well read on the subject. I don't think there's a lot of work that does this. And when I read it, I'm like, this is actually a very valuable thing that we could have. And I would advise whoever is listening in, U.S. foreign policy to pick this book up and read it, because it does raise important arguments that's not in a lot of the literature. So I commend you for doing that.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, it's my intention to show that there's more to liberalism than people think. And especially, I must say, in American academia, where liberalism is, of course, what we in Europe would think is something like social democracy or socialism even. And that's the main thing in the history of liberal ideas, that the term liberalism has taken as well can mean it's one thing and its opposite, truly actually. So I've tried to to make some more sense out of it and propose a really in my view at least I've tried to propose just the, you know, three you can divide up liberalism and liberal thought and liberal ideology just in three. You know, that's complicated enough, I think.
Yeah, and it's a very good way of thinking about it, and it's a good segue into the way you break it down into three different three different types to use as a framework. So let's start with classical liberalism. I was wondering if you could tell our listeners what is classical liberalism, one of the three broad categories you use to define liberalism.
Well, classical liberalism is the liberalism it all started with. So it originates from the 18th century, especially from the Enlightenment. And it's the liberalism of the great Scots, for example, David Hume and Adam Smith, but perhaps also the French Enlightenment thinkers like Voltaire. And the main idea of that kind of liberalism is that you should leave people alone, or at least you should not interfere with their what we would now call their basic human rights or their negative human rights, which means, I mean, you have to see it in context that these people were fighting or struggling or arguing against absolute kings, very dominant churches. They wanted to be, their plea was for tolerance for individuals making their own decisions about their own lives. And the good thing about that, they thought, and this is also, of course, related to the strict protection of property rights, individual property rights. And the great thing about that, classical liberal think, is that if you leave people alone, and here we come to the issue of spontaneous order. If you leave people alone, they will interact with each other. They will trade with one another. And the result of this will be that there will be order in societies because people are innate social species. So they live together because they want to live together. You know, the few exceptions, of course. But most people are want to live together. And this is very well put in Smith's theory of moral sentiment, which in his own time he was far more famous than we now know The Wealth of Nations, also because The Wealth of Nations was written much later in his life. But spontaneous order is a core concept of classical liberalism. And also the idea that the state should be limited. It's not abolished, like libertarians would say, or very minimal. No, the state should be limited to a small amount of tasks that help to create a good order for classical liberals and for individual people to flourish. The basis of their view on human nature, which I think is also a very relevant view of human nature of classical liberalism, is that man should be seen as a person who is directed both by emotions and by reason. It's a mix, but in the end, reason wins. Hume put it very, very eloquently, saying that the reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions, and I think that's very well put. So, negative freedom, realistic view of human nature, spontaneous order, and a limited state—these are the core concepts of classical liberalism. Then you, of course, we'll find that classical liberals are also much in favor of the rule of law or constitutionalism, which means that, you know, the state has to base its action against the individual on rules which were adopted prior to that particular action. And to protect the individual against the state even better, the most important rules should be put in a constitution. And the advantage of the constitution, of course, is that it's much harder to change than a regular law. So that serves as extra protection. So these are, I think, the core ideas in my view, but this is this will raise more eyebrows, I think. I follow Knut Håkonsson in his idea that classical liberals are natural law thinkers. So the idea that there is a natural order between people, so this is not about utilitarianism, as some people would have classified classical liberalism. I think if you go to Hume and Smith, but also to Hayek, these are all natural law thinkers. I've tried to make that clear in the first book I talked about in the introduction.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of thinking about it. When I read this, every time I think of classical liberalism, I think of two things. I think of the students in my class who have no idea what classical liberalism is. Like even today, a kid, we were talking about progressivism, and he just cried out, seemingly out of nowhere, "Those damn liberals," the first thing out of his mouth. And I'm also thinking about the idea that the American Revolution is somehow, I've read this argument in various places, is like a classical liberal revolution. You sometimes hear the term Lockean, you hear other ways of putting about it, but that is classical liberalism put into effect. Is that an argument that you find persuasive, or is it more complicated than that, or misleading?
Well, I'm not an expert on the American Revolution, but I think most people actually in America draw on Locke and his idea of the property rights, the strict defense of property rights, and in that sense, I think it's certainly a classical liberal idea and a classical liberal historical act. Although Locke himself was not much of a classical liberal, in his ideas on economy, he was more like a socialist, really. And of course, he supported. Yeah, I think he was a slave owner also. But in his, in his property rights theory, he certainly was influential, and I think he also influenced, although not that much, the Scottish thinkers I just mentioned. But of course, the idea that you want to be free, you don't want to be ruled by someone else, and certainly not a state, on the other side of an ocean, who's taxing you, who wants you even to take up arms for that particular colonial order. Well, I think these are all, if you reject those ideas, then you're certainly a classical liberal.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point about Locke. I mean, he's a very interesting figure, I think. And most Americans, if they know Locke at all, the first thing they'll think of is Declaration of Independence and Jefferson. But I'm glad you brought up in the book that his credentials as a liberal or as someone who believes in freedom is very, very complex. And it's not simply an easy answer for that. So,
there's a whole literature on that, of course. I know that some Locke scholars have a bit of a different view, but it's never really clear cut. And I if you read Locke's biography by Roger Woolhouse. then you don't find much evidence of Locke being much of a classical liberal outside his theory of property rights.
So we have classical liberalism. I was wondering if you could tell us how classical liberalism differs from the next term you use, social liberalism.
Sure. Yeah, I think socialism was a reaction to classicalism. From, say, in the 19th century, so say from the 1830s onwards. It was a reaction also under influence of, the rise of communism and socialism. And John Stuart Mill is much of a pivotal figure here, because he set out as a true classical liberalism. and his work on political economy, for example, is, you know, was used way into the 20th century in classrooms, and there's nothing wrong with that. And On Liberty, of course, is a famous tract where you can find much classical liberal ideas. But in the end, the social liberals banned it with the societal tide, if I may call it that way. And they what they did is they adapted to the times and changed their ideas. So instead of negative freedom, they had a view of positive freedom. And this dichotomy between negative freedom and positive freedom, of course, was only invented much later by Isaiah Berlin in the 1960s, but still it's a very well-known set of concepts. But a positive idea, but a positive freedom, which means that people should develop themselves, and because every individual has a set of talents which should be, and he or she should be able to use those talents, but and these are known to that particular person, but it's not always feasible or possible for that person to use those talents. And here comes the state, because there the state should help out. And that's, of course, where the trouble begins, at least from a classical liberal perspective. Social liberals think that that self-development is also social justice. So the so people should be helped, or should we have access to education, for example, or access to a extended social welfare system, just to be able to raise themselves up more or less, or to use the talents they have for whatever particular direction they bring them. And this all depends on an extended state. And of course, if you look at the development into the 20th century, with John Rawls as the big social liberal person, but he's, well, of course, he's used and seen as an example also by social democratic thinkers, or even socialist thinkers, but certainly also by social liberal thinkers. And then you have the idea of the social justice idea. Well, it's even more important there. Also the idea of to have a very extended welfare state. So that means that social liberals don't take the idea of private property rights as serious as the classical liberals do. Because obviously you need to raise taxes to get taxes, you need to you need to take it from people, which is a breach of a property right, obviously. What they think is that classical liberals, they are very happy to live in a world where only the classical human rights, or natural rights as they were called, are about. And you have to think like the freedom of expression, freedom of religion, those kinds of rights. But we've seen in the past decades that the human rights catalog has expanded dramatically, and that pretty much fits very well with social liberalism. There also the belief is not so much in natural law, but there's a social contract idea that the community or people living together in a state have a social contract with each other. And that means they also have duties to one another, which often are expressed or given practical expression through state interference. Property right, another important idea for social liberals is that they see much more of a role for positive law, so not so much a spontaneous order, but positive law which originates again from the state, which is meant to bring order to society.
Yeah, those are interesting points. When I read your book, I kept thinking about Rawls, and I was wondering if you could say more about what did you find, how you reacted to his arguments when you first encountered them. Because when I was an undergrad, I went to Yale as an undergrad. He was very much in vogue. A class after class was talking about him. I mean, he had wrote, I believe that his famous work was from the 70s. But he was still being talked about. Students were reading him. Now, sometimes I thought some students carried around his book. Literally not all, obviously, like almost like a Mao, you know, red book in China. So I was wondering if you could just say a little more about what
I
you
think that's
take
still the case. Because many people actually think that or claim that political philosophy was dead until Rawls, A Theory of Justice, which was indeed published in 1971. And much of modern political philosophy is still working out Rawls. I've been a visiting professor at Brown University previously this year, and there in the political philosophy department, indeed, Rawls was taught, and the modern philosophers who react to Rawls where it was still thought at at PhD level. So I think it's still the case that Rawls is seen as the liberator somehow. But of course he's not really liberating, at least not from a classical liberal perspective, because it's some people, some commentators, of course, think Rawls didn't go far enough with the idea of social justice. So they propose, you know, far more ideas to make the world as equal to everybody. And others follow Rawls and still think that he wrote the right words, so to say. The thing is that what is, of course, appealing of his ideas is that, it's hard to oppose social justice. You know? If you ask somebody, are you against social justice? Then it's hard to say no, at least not in the Western world, because it sounds very appealing and very reasonable and very nice. And, you know, it's about nice people. But it's, you know, there's a lot of disadvantage about the idea as well, because the a greater government, and I live in the Netherlands where, you know, the government takes more than 50% of my income to redistribute that money. Some of it I approve, a lot of it I disapprove, but it's taken, in the end, of course, it's taken at gunpoint. So that means that I'm not as free as I would like to be. Rawls gives a good mix of recipes for a just society. So there's a long list of proposals he makes. Also in his successor book called Political Liberalism, in 1993. He adjusts a little bit after the critiques, but he still remains at the same path of public financing for elections, the guarantee for sufficient public information on policy decisions, the guarantee of equal opportunities for all in education and training, provision of basic health care for all, which I guess is a very topical discussion in America still. The guarantee of a decent division of income and property in order to keep in check the influence of wealthy people who can use political power for their own interests. Enter Donald Trump, perhaps. Guarantee employment for all through local government or other arrangements. These are quite heavy ideas from a classical liberal perspective. And even a lot of social democrats won't go as far anymore as this list of ideas by Rawls.
Yeah, I mean, the questions you just raised are fundamental questions that liberalism addresses, but I mean, any society has to deal with those types of questions, which is, you know, one of the reasons your book is relevant to anybody who has any interest in how the world works and how politics works. So you can pick up and read about how people have ideas about how fundamental questions of how societies are ordered are addressed by, you know, these schools of thought that are the framework that you have, and by individual thinkers. So I think, you know, just from that level, it's an important book to read to, you know, understand and have arguments about, you know, how your society is going.
Yeah, I mean, my claim is that you cannot understand, at least not in the West, you cannot understand your society without having knowledge about liberalism.
Sure, and you make that case convincingly in my mind. But I think now's a good time to segue into the third of your the framework or the breakdowns that you use, libertarianism.
Yeah.
Wonder if you could say more about that idea.
Sure, yeah. Libertarianism also originates from the 19th century. And in a way, it's also a commentary on classical liberalism, but then towards the other way. And the other way meaning that libertarians are the absolute freedom people. There are two main strands of libertarianism. Of course, there are many more, but two main ones. First are the ones who don't want a state at all, no state, which are the anarcho-capitalists. And there's another strand that wants a very minimal state. So a state that only provides police, justice, the protection of property rights in a way, and perhaps foreign and defense. So three tasks only, and that's about it. The libertarians also in general have a negative freedom idea. So they see people as strong, but as a mix of emotions and reason. They strongly believe in the protection of private property rights. It's a core issue for libertarianism. And they have a very high faith in spontaneous order, because libertarians put in a lot of work to give evidence that their society would work, because the critique on libertarianism is always that, you know, it's a very bad society where, you know, people will perish because, you know, it's a good society for the strong, but not for the weak. And libertarians try to give counter evidence, saying that just that the state is not providing all services doesn't mean those services would not exist in a libertarian society. It's just that, you know, the private companies and the market will take care of social, security, or insurance for social security, all kinds of that. Claim that, like Hans Hermann Hoppe, that insurance companies can even take care of national defense, which I'm personally not convinced by the idea, but still, it's within the anarcho-capitalist. It's a well-discussed idea. Libertarians are very strong natural law believers, and as I said, strong defenders of property rights. And they really, they write a lot of books about how good their society would be. One woman stands out. It's Ayn Rand, who's of course very well known in America, or at least less so in Europe, I must say. But she claims to have invented her own form of libertarianism called objectivism. But that can be seen as a form of minarchism, so the people who would like to see a very limited state only.
What do you make of her appeal in America? I mean, not that you have your pulse on everything that goes on here. I'm fascinated. I've read a few of her works. Not the entire. I can't say I went through all of them page by page, but I've read what she's written. I've read a few biographies, and I just can't quite put my finger on why she was so popular. She is popular on college campuses.
Yeah.
The university I teach at, Ferris State, has essentially what amounts to an Enron fan club that shows up at events and quotes objectivist material in books. I can't remember the one, the book, the guy where the guy rather blows up his hotel or the building he creates because it's changed by, I can't remember the title of it. I'm blanking. Say that again.
Fountainhead.
Yes, I think that's it. I mix up the titles, but the they know this stuff.
I love Ayn Rand. I think I'm not a Randian. I'm not an objectivist, but I think her work is great. I'm trying to get an article on her ideas on international relations published at the moment. I've went through almost all of her work. What fascinates me is that, indeed, she was able to get a large following, even, just a few years until her death in the early 80s. If you read audios, if you listen to audio tapes, her accent was very, very heavy. So, it's very hard to follow. But she made the emotional case for liberty, whereas the other liberals are very much economist dominated ideas. Economists are nice people, but their way of argument is not always appealing to people. It's abstract. It's a bit cold. You have to, follow their argument with, you need basic information for that. At least it's different than the emotional appeal Ayn Rand makes, and I think that's what really stands out in her work. And I think in the 60s she was also against the Vietnam War, so she sided, with the left more or less. And she was popular among people in that movement, but in the end she was of course a charismatic leader, with a small following, which they called themselves even the collective as a joke, and she was a bit like an authoritarian leader as well, because she it was all the signs of a cult there. But if you read her, she, not all her ideas are brilliant, and she wrote funny or, silly things as well. But in the end, she succeeded in a pretty coherent philosophy, and which stands out to an extent from other liberals. But in the end, I think it's fair to say that she's a after all.
Yeah, and she's an interesting figure to transition to the next part of your book, which deals with the relationship between liberalism and conservatism. Yeah. Because when I've been doing research recently at Hoover Institution at Stanford University, I was looking at some really unprocessed papers of the Young Americans for Freedom. And a lot of those early documents had debates between the various factions in the Republican Party, including a lot of libertarians, were showing up at these meetings, quoting Ayn Rand and how to deal with that. And, they definitely, influence became, part of the Republican landscape in the 60s and into the 70s. I mean, it even influenced the thinking of people like Alan Greenspan and so forth. I guess what I'm getting at is, where is that line between liberalism and conservatism, as far as you define it in your book?
I think the line is the main point is that in my view, conservatives are most closely related to the classical liberals and less so to social liberals and libertarians. What makes them they share a realistic view of human nature. Sometimes are fierce defenders of individual rights and freedom, for example, in the Thatcher and Reagan era. But that's not always the case. So the neoconservatives, for example, during the Bush Jr. or, well, I must say, the first Bush Jr. Era, were, of course, not about small states, because they advocated huge state involvement, big state spending. So conservatives are not always you cannot pin down conservatives because outside their core beliefs in the realistic view of human nature, the idea of organic change. So they're not against change as some people would have it. So no, conservatives are not always defenders of the status quo, but the change that goes on, they feel should be organic in order to preserve the good things that were given to us by our parents and generations before that. They believe that, you know, society as it is should not be changed drastically just by one generation, because they would demolish the wisdom of the ages, as they call it. So the conservatives are often a counter movement. So if the left is on is governing, they will lean to the right, and vice versa. Just, you know, which makes sense from their perspective, because if you want to preserve the way things are, then of course you need to have a counterbalance the main power of the moment. Conservatives are more concerned with religion, although all three strands of liberalism are, you know, are perfectly able to have religious ideas as well. So liberalism is not anti-religion at all. But conservatism are, you know, they feel stronger for religion and religious ideas, because they think that's also part of human heritage. They feel the groups and family are important. So it's not, conservatives are not individualists. You know, they care more about groups and family in particular. They also believe in the in hierarchy in society, whereas liberals, of course, think, you know, one man, one vote, one, you know, all individuals should have equal moral rights and moral status. Conservatives think that, you know, some hierarchy is good, and sometimes you just have to follow the leaders, you know, who are people with extra talents. And so they should be followed by the others. And if they're, you know, not leaning towards the liberal side, of course, they have a very active state. So they don't care if a state, if there's law, positive law, that, you know, goes against individual liberty, because in the end, that's not their main concern. So you cannot trust conservatives with individual liberty, which is, of course, the core concept of all three forms of liberalism.
Yeah, I found this chapter very interesting, because the debates we have in the Republican Party here in the United States about what is conservatism. Is it, you know, the idea of individual freedom, autonomy from government? Is it the religious angle defining freedom? Or in terms of, you know, more of group rights and relationships that bind society together, or things focus on the moral order, like with the issue of gay marriage. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the Americans are debating what conservatism is, and it inevitably overlaps with these ideas of liberalism you're talking about. So once again, for Americans listening to this broadcast, this is a good book that will make you more informed of these debates and, you know, give you the ammunition to address the arguments that you're hearing by these politicians. So once again, well done on that note.
Thanks. Yeah, you're welcome.
And another thing that comes up when you get into chapter 5 and you begin to define the evolution or the differences between liberalism and conservatism, it raises the issue of the kind of, I would call it by reading this book, the neo game. You know, the issue of neoconservatism and neoliberalism when people put neo labels on. And you deal with neoconservatism, and you can say more about that if you want to, but you really go after this idea of neoliberalism. And I was wondering if you could say more about that.
First of all, indeed, people make up their own political philosophy all the time. And the adjective neo is very popular. I think the neoconservatives, as I said, they have been influential for a while. They were very much engaged with cultural issues, and they did not care as much about, you know, the expansion of the state. So that's really something to keep in mind. Neoliberals, on the other hand, my claim is that neoliberalism doesn't exist. It's a phantom idea. It's made up by opponents of liberalism, so from the left, and it's hard to find anybody who calls himself neoliberal. So it's really just a construct it's like a basket a term where, you know, you can, everything that goes wrong in the world, you can blame on neoliberalism. At least that's what the anti-neoliberals try to do. And in my view, that's just, you know, it's empty, it's without meaning, and it's simply not true, because it's only used in, well, socialist circles, social democratic circles, but not as much in liberal service, although it has been in the past a couple of years in Germany. But that was only, you know, a few years before and after the Second World War. There's many wrong liberalisms, but the neoliberalism is, I guess, it's a favorite swear word of the left. And it's a shame that, you know, nobody, no liberal really stands up, or not many liberals stands up to defend the true meaning of liberalism, because journalists, of course, take the term, regular people take over the term. Before you know it, it's seen as something that's real, but it's, you know, like, as I said, it's hollow, and it's a phantom.
Yeah, and I didn't know much about the early history of the idea earlier, or the early history of the idea that you describe in the book, so that was interesting as well. But you're right, it is one of those terms that comes around that people just use to criticize stuff. We see it all the time.
It's a shame that, for example, even Oxford University, which press, which is supposed to be a very good press, in their they publish books on this, you know, and in their very short, little books they publish on all kinds of topics. It's just, you know, it's a one way street the way they portray and present neoliberalism. And it's, in their view, the liberalism they use is a bit of a mix of conservatism, classical liberalism, and libertarianism. And the main threat is, and the main theme is, of course, that the market is the evil source of all wrongs. That's basically what it is. And, you know, it's anti-capitalist. Big companies are always to blame, and so forth.
Yeah, that's my sense of it too. It's used as a critique of capitalism.
Yeah,
is what I see a lot of it.
Yeah,
but anyways, another part of your book we haven't said that much about, and this is a question you may not be able to answer in the short time frame we have. But if you could just tell the listeners maybe a little bit about what each of these schools tell us about foreign affairs. I mean, once I said this is a question that might take. You could probably spend an hour on talking, but if you look at these philosophies, how do they relate to foreign affairs? I mean, if you could, you know, summarize that.
No, that's, thanks for asking that, because that is one of the things I really care a lot about. What they think in domestic affairs is also what they think in international affairs. So, for example, classical liberals, they think conflict is inevitable in any society because, you know, as I said, humans are fallible and emotion takes over, which you know means that they will not always be able to follow the rational path, given, well, assuming for the moment just that not having not a fight is rational. But for classical liberals, that's not the case. And they think, well, if conflict is a feature of domestic affairs, it's also a feature of international affairs, because international affairs is also about people. So conflict and war are perpetual features of international affairs. In essence, that's because due to human nature. So the question for classical liberals is not how to get rid of war, but how to deal with war, and maybe to limit war, you know, at most. One thing also is that, and this is my, I can talk about it for many more than 1 hour, but the idea that trade brings peace, which is, of course, a very prominent idea in international relations among liberals, is not a classical liberal idea, because trade will not reduce or eliminate the sources of war or international conflict. Trade's great. Trade brings prosperity. Trade brings cultural exchange. Trade, has a lot of other advantages. But trade is unable to get, to reduce or eliminate sources of war, such as, because wars are, are not always founded on economic issues. Some is geopolitical, there will be religious issues, there will be border issues. These things will just remain no matter how much you trade. And of course, history is on my side here. If you look at the former trading partners who are just as happily or not happily go to war with each other. For classical liberals, also, it's important that the nation state is seen as the primary actor in international relations, because they feel that it's very hard, if not impossible, for individual people to have strong feelings for beyond the nation state. So the nation state is somewhat like the outer limit or the outer bound of meaningful emotions. And you need these emotions to keep together a state. So it's, therefore nation states are the prime actor. The idea of spontaneous order, you will also find in international relations, and that's then the idea of balance of power. So the idea that, because there's no judge, of course, so there's no international judge with the same power as a judge or a court in the national situation. So how to deal with each other, how to get international order? Well, it can be done spontaneous as well, well, to an extent at least, by balancing. So, the Cold War, of course, was a great example where you had the Soviet bloc, you had the American bloc with their allies, and they were both, well, more or less equal, at least for some time. And while this prevented war between those big powers, which could have warped civilization away with all the nuclear weapons around, sometimes they were fought proxy wars, so to say. But this, while terrible if you're in that, these of course were not as bad as a big war between the huge powers. Another idea of classical liberal IR of international relations is that if war is conducted, you should at least try to stick to the just war principles, which mean both rules for how to get into war and rules for how to behave in war. So, for example, you should not you should have a real cause of war. You should declare war, but you should always leave civilians out of the combat, for example. Because classical liberals are in favor of individual liberty, imperialism and colonialism is not part of classical liberal ideas on international relations at all. They want a small state in the domestic society, which means they also want a small state in or a small state-like organizations in the international situation, which means a they're very hesitant for towards international organizations such as the United Nations or their satellite organizations. They have a very they're very hesitant also about the majority of positive international law and treaties, because most of the time these are binding and harder to change than laws in the domestic society. And from the 50s onwards, they've been very strong opponents of development aid, which goes back to the ideas of Peter Bauer, who says development aid is only about taking money from the poor in rich countries and bring it to the rich in poor countries.
That's a good quote.
Yeah. And for example, Hayek and Mises agreed with that. And well, of course, the issue of the of military intervention, which is one of those perpetual issues in international relations as well. Well, they were very hesitant towards military intervention. I've looked into it, and I wrote a chapter in another book about this. Hume and Smith, they basically thought a military intervention is a bad idea because the success rate would be very limited. Although they did not close the door completely, you know, they there may have been some reason once in a while, if a you know, a king or a leader thought that would be a good idea, and he could explain it to this to his people. But in general, this is you know, military interventions are a no-go area for classical liberal. So that would be classical liberal ideas on IAR very quickly. Whereas the social liberals, again, oppose or have a different views. They think that, well, people are reasonable and therefore world peace is attainable because, well, people are able to see the advantages of a world peace. And they think, well, international positive law and international organizations are actually a very good vehicles to attain world peace, or at least to get to go into the right direction. They do think that free trade fosters democracy and peace through the idea that trade makes ties between countries and between people in countries, and as law, and they also have it also creates interest groups. Domestic interest groups who all are able to limit the desire of governments to go to war. So for them, free trade is related to interdependence, democracy, all fosters peace. They do think military intervention is justified because it may be, it must be used sometimes to enforce global justice. So global justice doesn't always. Well, in their view, at least, it's not a spontaneous order issue, but it's an active state involvement issue. And this is actually the liberalism found in most IR textbooks and in political philosophy, as the Scottish philosopher Nicholas Renger said, in the academic global justice industry. This is the kind of ideas you will find. And it's all, they were also... more or less written about by Rawls, although he was a bit more realistic, a bit more leaning to the classical liberal side in his book on international relations, much to the disappointment of many of his followers, obviously. And there's another industry around that book, which was published later, just before his death, well, in the 90s. And it's called the Law of Peoples, which is his main book on this issue. Libertarians, well, they also strive for peace and actively a post-war. And for example, following Robert Higgs, they point out the hidden costs of war. Say that, for example, a war in wartime, government extends their powers, extends their grip on society, and these extensions are never cut back after peace, which is true, but it doesn't really solve the issue of the causes of war, obviously. Just because it's bad, it's not going away. Classical liberals would argue against that. Libertarians are very much about self-defense, so they believe that, you know, countries should not interfere in other countries. They stress they're not pacifists, but still, you know, only relying on strict self-defense. Well, this is also a bit of a USA-centered idea, because relying on self-defense is fine if you're, you know, one of the biggest nations in the world. But it's a bit hard if you're Luxembourg or if you're well, the Netherlands for that matter. So it's not, you know, this is not a very practical idea. Well, for the as I just mentioned, that some of the anarcho-capitalists believe that defense should be a private insurance issue, a state issue, and they develop all kinds of plans to show that this will work. They also believe in guerrilla warfare, at least some of the libertarians, meaning that you know, even though a foreign country or foreign or foreign force may invade your country, you just you try to get them out by guerrilla warfare, thinking that this will be a better way to get people out than, you know, all out war against the intruders. The Minarchists are very isolationist, so they are, you know, which is of course a very traditional American stand, at least in the 18th and 19th century. They are strong believers that foreign trade fosters peace. Well, with the classical liberals, obviously they also oppose international law, international organizations, military intervention, and imperialism. But again, Ayn Rand stands out, because she was very much in favor of military intervention, and she had a very very active foreign policy ideas with strong military might, and so she stands out on this front again, I would say.
Yeah, when I read the section on libertarianism and foreign policy, and rightly or wrongly, I suppose, I couldn't get the image out of the Mad Max movies out of my head. I don't just that the idea that if you had private armies, private companies or groups of people in these, you know, communities that had private armies, why the basic laws of human nature wouldn't apply to them. It seems a stretch for me. I'm not sure. I mean, if I remember correctly from the book, you're skeptical about a lot of these arguments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am. I must stress, I'm not, you know, I don't want to just criticize libertarianism.
Sure.
That's not my idea, but I've took some time to write about Herman Hoppe's idea of defense as private insurance. And if you make the analysis, then his idea is lacking in substance. You know, it relies on a few ideas which are a bit simple, so it's not thought out at all, I would say. So if you maybe it's possible to make the case, but it's not made yet.
Sure. And that's kind of an abrupt segue, but what I found was another interesting part of your book is how you make these distinctions based on the size of the government and how that fits into the certain categories that you use, that this percentage of income, or what is it, percentage of GDP? That a government spends, I can't remember exactly how you worded it, that this fits libertarianism, this fits classical liberalism, this is social liberalism in terms of how much the government extracts and then redistributes.
Yeah, this is a bit of a rough of thumb thing, because in my book I use a different framework, the one by Michael Friedan and his ideas on ideologies, which are in his idea conceptual ideas, which, you know, because by comparing the structure of the concepts, you can compare ideologies. But you know, if we try to keep it simple, then of course, as a small rule of thumb, I suggest that, you know, if you look at the take of government of GDP, then for example, a good way to distinguish between those three forms I just mentioned would be, for example, for libertarians, you know, any between zero and say 20-25 is a just way of the government take, whereas for classical liberalism it would be anywhere say between 20 and 30 perhaps. And well, for social liberals, because they need more money for all those state tasks, it could run up to 50%, but never more than that, because if the government takes a larger share than 50% of the economy, it basically means that all people are slaves of the state. Mm-hmm. And that's the case in many European countries. People don't feel it that way, which is evidence that Hayek was right in his idea of the road to serfdom, because the road to serfdom was actually the road that people would lead to a situation where people would always look to the state for answers and were enslaved by the state because of the governmental take from the economy. So Hayek was right in this way. But as a rule of thumb, you can use that, and I it's a bit of a side idea I included in the book just to keep it simple.
Yeah, I mean, I like that about the book, and I think it's an interesting way to start discussions, because that line, and wherever it is, between social liberalism and social democracy, I think is an interesting one and relevant for our listeners, because right now in the United States, if I can simplify a lot of things, we're having a debate. There are a lot of authors out there, from Jeffrey Sachs to any number of people, the economist Jeffrey Sachs, that are, if you read their arguments, they're pretty much saying that the United States, in order to progress or become a more competitive country and deal with its problems, needs more social democracy. As far as I can, that's what it boils down to, because we're talking about, you know, countries like Sweden having more social mobility than the many Americans do now because of the gaps in wealth and the inner city versus the suburbs. Yeah. And one of the reasons I like your book is it will give people a way to enter those debates. I mean, at the end of the day, where do you kind of see that whole argument that America needs more social democracy? Is that just people are,
I don't,
shouldn't follow the example of Europe? They should step back and look at the bigger picture, or how do you?
I don't think there's any reason to follow Europe in this respect. There's no reason to why you should not be able to solve the problems if the government takes less of GDP. It's only a matter of, you know, how you spend your money and what programs you have, and so there's no obvious answer in the European situations. That, you know, and not forgetting that in the U.S., I think the government at least in some states already takes 40% of GDP or state GDP. Mm-hmm. You know, it's whereas in Europe, people always warn for American situations, you know, and they mean indeed that you know the problems of the urban poor, and the fact that, you know, you're not insured against all kinds of risks. I don't think it's a good idea for the U.S. to take much ideas from Europe in this respect at all.
It's an interesting argument. I don't know if you've read that new book called The Fourth Revolution by the former editor of The Economist, the two guys. One's named Micklewaite, I believe.
Mm, I haven't. So.
Well, I mean, their argument is essentially that the United States needs would be better off in adopting. They consciously call themselves liberals. If you have time, it might be something worth reading, because they think that liberalism and many of the ideas that you talk about here would be better for the United States to have a more effective but smaller state. Like, they think the recipe isn't becoming bigger and taking more money. It's actually doing a smaller number of things better in order to create a better society. I mean, that's the gist of their book in a nutshell. It's not bigger is better. It's reduce, but do those things you reduce better, and then you can have a leaner, more liberal government. Yeah. So that sounds kind of what you're
That sounds like my kind of idea,
And I guess another area where your book might come into at least have relevance in terms of, you know, the way the world works today. A lot of people would, I think, say that these liberal ideas don't have much relevance for countries that are poor or non-Western countries. Like, liberalism is basically a function of the West. It's an emphasis on individuality. Like, is China going to, you know, benefit from liberal approaches or even see them as relevant, or that they're too poor? I mean, how would you respond to those arguments that liberalism is simply something that's only suitable for the West?
Well, I think people should look at this, at Southeast Asia. I've been lucky enough to live 4 years in the Philippines, so I've seen it with my own eyes. But also China, perhaps. And ask yourself, so how did those countries develop themselves? And, you know, what did they do? Well, basically, they embraced liberal ideas, liberal economic ideas, of course, in first instance. You know, the market, capitalism, individual entrepreneurs who were allowed to to do their thing, and that's the way forward. It's a huge success. Southeast Asia are evidence that liberalism actually works. And of course, it's not perfect there. It's not a liberal paradise yet. Because indeed, Singapore or countries like, there's corruption, there's authoritarian government, but, think of it, that's even, more proof that liberalism actually works, because despite all these setbacks at the international, individual level, you still have developed countries who've gained tremendously, and that helped a lot of people out of poverty. The idea is that I follow Milton Friedman in this, is of course that at a certain point in time, people want to have individual liberty as well. So they once they get affluent enough to have a good life, to don't worry about food or housing or shelter or clothing anymore, there will come a time that people demand more freedom as well. And I think in China, there's a lot of, local uprisings asking for more liberty. And I think, that happens sometimes in Southeast Asian countries as well. So I'm pretty optimistic about this, actually. I think liberalism will guide the world first through the economic part, but I'm pretty confident that the other parts of liberalism will follow.
Yeah, I think you make some very good arguments there, and I'd like to thank you for taking so much time to talk to me, but I can't help but ask you at least one more question about the book.
It's great to be.
And in terms of, like, it seems to me that these are arguments that people should be out there, hitting the pavement with to defend it in terms of progress. I think about your argument about Southeast Asia is absolutely correct, that in many universities and in many discourses, neoliberalism has more of a visible audience and a lot of people pay more attention to than basic liberal ideas. And a lot of the ways, I mean, not the only way, but you explain that as part of this idea of liberal confusion. And you draw this idea of the kind of the complex, or not the complexities, but the way things get muddled, so to speak, because of the way people kind of confuse or conflate political ideology versus political theory. And things get all kind of messed up in how people understand liberalism. I was wondering if you could say more about that and how people can, other than reading your book, can kind of come up with ways to defend these ideas better in practice.
You only have to look at the what liberal think tanks, classical liberal think tanks, put in the open. For I'm very much I love the Institute of Humane Studies, for example, and their Ideas in Liberty videos. The Cato Institute has great material. So, you know, there's many, there's a lot of, there's a lot of material out there to defend all kinds of, you know, impractical issues. My take in this book, of course, is that I treated the three variants of liberalism as ideology variants by using the framework of Michael Friedman. And the difference with political theory is that perhaps those three variants are less, you know, are not 100% logical, or, you know, they don't meet all criteria which you will put on a proper philosophy. But I think that's only right, because it doesn't make them less valuable. And if you look at the main thinkers, the main liberal thinkers, most of them were not full-time academics. John Stuart Mill was not, David Hume was not, Adam Smith was a long time of his life, but not his whole life. Hayek was a professor, but Mises was not. You know, it's only within the 20th century with academic specialization that you will see more full-time professors adding to the adding ideas to the three liberals, to the three forms of liberalism. But I think the Friedman framework is very, very valuable. And it's all about, you know, it's not about the labels. It's about the content going that fills the ideas. So it's the different concept that fill the idea of classical liberalism. It's the different concepts that fill social liberalism. And it's the different concept that fill libertarianism. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they overlap and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they have the same core ideas, like individual, the desire to expand individual liberty. But sometimes they just have different different views on things. And it's not easy to detect, but it's detectable if you take time and read, and read a lot. That's basically what you have to do.
Sure. And another argument that I hear, I mean, just in reading and talking to people, is this idea that, well, liberalism may do all this good stuff, and I'm defining it roughly as, you know, this idea of individual freedoms and economic freedom and so forth. But at the end of the day, you know, it's just producing countries like the United States, which consist mainly of people interested in consumption and watching terrible television, and they're not disengaging from politics, and civil society's weakening. Even, what's his name, Francis Fukuyama, who wrote, you know, the End of History thesis, worried about the future in terms of people just, you know, the big great decisions in life would boil down whether to buy a big screen TV or a new car or something like this. I mean, in your research and what you just encountered maybe in the intellectual debates out there, how do you respond to arguments that, you know, one of the shortcomings of liberalism is it doesn't promise something greater than basic individual fulfillment?
I think it's laughable. These are, you know, this is just silly arguments, because these people either only read the wrong papers or don't look at their fellow citizens at all. I mean, it's just basically not true. It's not what people do. Sure, they might like may like a big television, but then they go out to church and volunteer in you know, some kind of thing, or some kind of initiative, or you know, they go to school to support their kids, or they coach the teams, or, you know, people, that's what people do. So it's just silly to reduce people to either their role as consumers, or, you know, any other role. Basically, people are too complicated for that, and that's just the great thing about liberalism, that they take into account the differences between people, and they take into account what people are really are. So that's why the view on human nature is such an essential issue of classical liberal and all liberal thought. So it's just, you know, it's just not true. That's my take.
Yeah, I definitely see your argument. I wanted to throw it out there, because sure, I do see that from time to time in books. and this idea of centralized planning will come up every now and then when the economy goes down or you have terms that they're immediately, I mean, they talked about this in the 80s about centralized planning and, you know, it came around today. So, I mean, these arguments come in cycles when things seem to be going bad, but I think you've hit the nail on the head with a lot of the points that you made. And another thing that strikes out to me, a lot of people who make these arguments, I don't think have a full understanding of why communism failed. I mean, and it's well established. I'm not saying scholars haven't written about it, and they've written amazing stuff about it. But just to go back and think about people who couldn't go to the grocery store to get nails to fix their just basic things you take for granted in a society. Stand in
line for a pair of shoes, for a whole day. No, it was terrible. I mean, and there has been some great work done. For example, at George Mason University, and other centers, it was bad. Communism was bad, and it was bad for people, and they didn't want it. And they had a black market on the side, which the of course the leaders allowed, because otherwise people would starve out of hunger. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't work. If you need a gun to keep people in place, in check, to follow your idea, then something is wrong with the idea.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good way of putting it. And another thing, just what struck me about life in the Soviet Union, and then that's one of the things I write on in my research. It had to be explained to me that the Soviet citizens carried sacks everywhere. Because they didn't know when stuff would be available. So people were walking around with sacks and they'd see something, these bags, and then they would just buy it because they didn't know what was going to be out on the shelves any given day. I just find that fascinating. I tell my students that, and they look at each other like that's the craziest thing they've ever heard.
People had to be put on waiting lists for cars. And if you were a party member, you had a better position on the waiting list. And, it was just, it's just a bad society. Look at North Korea at the moment. Look at Cuba. They couldn't hold it out. They had to let go their ideas, because their ideas didn't work, and liberalism does work.
Well, they barely worked in Cuba when they got all sorts of good Soviet aid.
If they needed the aid and still didn't work.
So anyways, well, thank you for those comments. And, I've taken so much of your time, and I thank you for talking with me. But for the last question, I was wondering if you might tell the audience a little bit more about what your future plans might be, whether that's teaching or scholarship.
Well, first of all, Christian, thanks a lot for having me, because it was really nice talking to you. And I was really excited. And I hope, some people will listen to this. Also, all the way down to the end.
Yes.
But my future, my research agenda is I first want to get my article published on Ayn Rand and international relations, and then I want to write something about the differences of the different liberalisms in the international relations theory. So in the short term, my work will be I will focus on scholarship, sometimes I'm a visiting scholar as well, which I really like. So I've taken some time at Brown University earlier this year, as I said. I've been a lecturer at Leiden University, and when I lived in the Philippines at the Ateneo University. So I always like to teach as well the interaction with students. But in the foreseeable future, I will not make my will not make it my main job, but
sure.
I just like and love to read and write about liberalism, so that's something I will always do.
Fair enough, and we definitely benefit from it. And once again, thank you for talking with me. This is a book that's very much worth reading. It's relatively short, so it's a book that you can pick up and read very easily, and it gives you as either an American citizen or a citizen from another country, a lot to think about and a lot that's relevant to understanding the world we live in. So once again, Edward, thank you for talking with me.
Christian, it has been my pleasure, and thanks for the kind word.
Talk to you later.